From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, an Election Day postmortem from the group that fought to reform voting in Michigan.
What we saw was 1,500 local clerks who battled through a pandemic and processed over 3 million absentee ballots and millions more in person. And they were professional, methodical, and worked really for the benefit of all voters.
Also, what polls and coverage often miss about the complex identity of Native American voters.
News organizations like CNN like for people to be in a nice compartmentalized racial category. You know, us Americans love to characterize people, classify people on the basis of race and sex, that sort of thing.
And two former GOP party chairs talk about where Michigan's GOP is headed after a mixed election day.
I don't think it's as easy just to say, well, Michigan's turned blue. It's more reasonable to say there was people that voted for Biden and they voted for Republicans too.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later in the show, we're going to speak with two former Michigan Republican Party chairs about where the GOP is headed post-Trump, or maybe not so post.
There's a lot of energy still around him in Michigan. He brought people in who had not voted before.
That's coming up. But first, it's been 1 week since Michigan's vote, and election results are mostly settled, but national Republican leaders following the president's lead are holding on to unfounded arguments about voter fraud that they say happened in Michigan. We wanted to touch base with someone who keeps very close tabs on elections, elections policy, and what the public thinks of elections. Nancy Wong is the executive director of Voters Not Politicians. In 2018, her group helped to convince voters to change Michigan's constitution, reforming the way congressional districts are drawn. Nancy Wong, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, with respect to the general election results, let's talk about where things stand with certification. November 17th is the date, right?
Right.
Are you feeling confident that Michigan's elections results can be certified between now and then?
Yes, I am confident. What we saw was 1,500 local clerks who battled through a pandemic and processed over 3 million absentee ballots and millions more in person. And they were professional, methodical, and worked really for the benefit of all voters, Republican and Democratic clerks alike. And that's something we should celebrate.
This is a little bit outside of the advocacy that Voters Not Politicians has been going through, but I just wanted to acknowledge that a judge has thrown out the Trump campaign's initial lawsuit challenging conditions in Oakland County. The Trump campaign today filed hundreds of pages of affidavits challenging tabulations procedures at the TCF Center in Detroit, this in pursuit of a new lawsuit challenging election results. Nancy, are you confident that Michigan's election procedures can withstand this level of scrutiny?
Yes, I am confident. You know, time and again, we've seen that the Trump lawsuits are not supported by any facts. They only contain, you know, anecdotal allegations. And when pressed by the courts, the Trump campaign really has never been able to come out with any sort of specific evidence of fraud or any other misconduct.
Michigan selects a slate of electors after elections, of course, that cast votes in the Electoral College. Do you have any concerns about the will of the voters being subverted in any way between now and then, or do you foresee the process moving forward as it usually does?
You know, I really have confidence in the state law that makes it very, very clear that our electors are going to be awarded to the winner of the popular vote in Michigan, which is Joe Biden. You know, what I'd like to see at this point, and as a citizen and as the leader of a nonpartisan voters' rights group, is I'd like to see our Republican leaders in the legislature really, you know, dismiss out of hand very clearly and vocally any suggestion that they might, you know, do anything to compromise our democracy. For example, by trying to appoint an alternative slate, you know, in violation of our state law.
Yeah. You know, the changes that were made in Michigan's Prop 3 some years ago just seem so prescient now, given that there are many, many voters who wanted to steer clear of in-person balloting on Election Day. Do you think that Michigan voters will continue to want to go absentee in the future? I mean, obviously, there were some public health reasons for it this year, but could you foresee this becoming a bigger part of the state's political culture?
You know, I do. You know, one of the reasons why Voters Not Politicians got in and really spent a ton of time and volunteer effort in our Vote Safe campaign was because we wanted to make sure that all voters really knew how many options they had for safe voting, you know, during the pandemic. But what we've seen is really voters embraced absentee voting and, you know, and other options too, right? Like drop boxes and expanded hours at clerk's offices. And what happened was, you know, what you see in other states happen in Michigan too, which is when you give the voters information that they need on how and the different ways they can make their voices heard, they really will take advantage of all those opportunities. And we saw, you know, 3.2 million absentee ballots being cast by absentee. And I think that just goes to show that voters really appreciate having that option and having really more convenient options in which they can exercise their vote.
The legislature provided a lot of support to make sure that a big absentee vote could be counted in a reasonable amount of time this year. There was extra cash for clerk's offices. There was a day of early ballot prep that was allowed. Do you think that we are where we need to be to support absentee voting over the long term? Or do you think that more structural changes are needed to help clerks with the work that they do?
You know, we did appreciate some of the steps that the legislature took, as well as some of the steps that the Secretary of State took as well. For example, in our August primary, to send absentee voter applications to every voter. And again, that was just so that voters, when they knew that they had that option, you know, could go ahead and request and then vote by absentee ballot. And then, as you mentioned, the legislature did grant clerks 10 hours before Election Day to start processing the ballot, meaning that they could take the absentee ballot out of the outer envelope. But there's a lot more room. There's a lot more steps that we can take, and we can learn from other vote-by-mail states like Colorado and Utah that have been doing this for decades now to make it possible for clerks to process an early count absentee votes. You know, so we aren't in that situation where they really are under a microscope and trying to process these, again, in a professional, accurate way, but under, you know, kind of time pressure. And then one of the things that Voters Not Politicians is advocating for is to go ahead and mail actual ballots out to every voter without, you know, the voters having to request an absentee ballot every election. Mm-hmm. So right now you can be on the permanent absentee list, but you still, that just means that you have to apply for an absentee ballot every election. So we think there's a lot of things that we can streamline in our process, again, just to carry out the will of the voters who've made it clear this election that they want more voting options and they want to vote as long as it's, you know, convenient and accurate and safe for them.
There's this idea that we maintain faith in our elections systems by keeping them very local, that people maybe know their local governance systems a little bit better and they see the people who are in charge of them, especially in smaller communities. Do you think that a local level election system is in a good position to stave off a national level erosion of confidence in elections, especially with what we're seeing among Donald Trump supporters right now?
Right. I do see those benefits that you mentioned in a locally administration system for our elections. You know, what we did see, so Voters Not Politicians, we had volunteer groups that were working with their local election officials to try to expand hours to, you know, early hours for registration and voting leading up to Election Day. And those types of efforts, you know, do instill a lot of confidence in people, you know, that their election administrators, regardless of party, again, are really working with the voters in their jurisdictions in mind. Again, you know, when we're talking about further reform efforts, I do see some streamlining and some efficiencies that we can see if we, you know, if we maybe take certain parts of the administration to maybe a county level. But I agree with you in general that, you know, when we have local officials that are interacting with the residents in their city or township, that does instill a measure of confidence that can override or kind of guard against some of the doubts that the, you know, the federal or the national parties are trying to sow in our electorate.
I've seen some Canadians remarking that in Canada, they feel that elections are too important to leave them up to regional governments, that they have to be, you know, fully funded independently on a national level. I mean, it seems like that might be a complicated prospect, though, in a country where national politics are having such a divisive influence on the way people feel about elections. Do you think that's true?
It's probably some sort of hybrid approach that is going to be the most effective and efficient for a state. But I really, in this day and age, you know, because of the hyper partisanship, and we're seeing this play out with the post-election, I'd say, issues and conversation, you know, I don't think that a national system would work very well in instilling voter confidence or even administration. I think you've seen in the coverage that, you know, state by state, there are a lot of procedures and you know, history and expectations that are different in each state. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend that we go all national, but on the state level, I think there's things that we can centralize. And then on the county level, like I said, again, I think there are things that counties can do with cities and townships to make sure that, you know, some things are handled in a more uniform way across counties, but that you would still have some local, you know, voter contact and control where voters can, you know, look to someone in their community to, you know, ask questions of and to deal with, you know, some of the issues that might come up with registration or casting a ballot.
Do you think there are other kinds of work that can and should be done to ensure confidence in voting?
Yeah, coming off the election, you know, there was a lot of unknowns, right, with the pandemic. For Michigan, it was the first general election where all voters could vote by absentee ballot without providing a reason. And there are groups like Voters Not Politicians that spent so much time on education and outreach trying to make sure that as many voters as possible who wanted to vote absentee and, you know, be safe during the pandemic could. And, you know, I think that's lost in a lot of the coverage now post-election, unfortunately, because of these unfounded challenges, that this election was a huge, huge success. And again, that's despite all these challenges that are, you know, in people's lives. I'm disappointed and kind of dismayed that we're not able to just see this as just a general success, because it really was. And, you know, I'm hoping this will lead to more reforms that are, you know, pro-voter or pro-democracy reforms in our state.
Nancy Wong is the Executive Director of Voters Not Politicians. Nancy, thank you so much for your time today.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
In just a moment, we check in on the Native American vote and the key role it played in this year and in past elections.
There's upwards of 100,000 Native people in the state that could vote. I think that our vote is sort of a sleeping giant.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There's been a great deal of discussion this election cycle about Black voters and Latinx voters' roles in winning Joe Biden the presidency. But what about Native American voters? In some swing states, tribal members may have played a key role as well. Today, we're joined by Matthew Fletcher. He is professor of law at Michigan State University's College Law and director of the Indigenous Law and Policy Center. Matthew, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be back.
So we know that in Michigan and across the country, there was historic voter turnout overall. And we also know that that includes turnout among some Native tribes. Can you talk a little bit about what got Native voters to the polls this year and what might have been at stake in their minds?
Well, you know, for the past couple decades, the national organizations like National Congress of American Indians and tribes themselves have been working to get Native people to vote more than they have before. And we're starting to see then in some of the states that where there is a lot of Indian country, that national elections for president, for Senate are very close. You know, 10, 20,000 votes can make a big difference. And if you have a state like Arizona, Wisconsin, Washington, Michigan, where you have more than just a few thousand Native voters, they can really create a block. And Native people are starting to realize that.
You mentioned Wisconsin and Arizona, and it certainly appears that Native voters in both spots may have helped to swing the election toward Joe Biden. There was also an interesting case in North Carolina where both Joe Biden and Donald Trump were really working hard to court votes from the Lumbee tribe and made promises to grant federal recognition. So after all that, Robeson County, which is about 40% Native, swung to Donald Trump this time around. We have certainly talked about the diversity of the Latinx vote these days, with Donald Trump winning key precincts in Texas and Florida. But do you think we talk enough about diversity in the native vote?
No, I don't think we do. You know, the Lumbee situation is really quite unique. There's no other tribe that is quite as large or as in such an unusual position of not being federally acknowledged as the Lumbees. And so that was sort of a unique circumstance. Mostly tribes tend to skew Democratic pretty significantly, but there are some places where the Republican Party can really step in a little bit and offer some things. There are tribes that we call energy tribes that rely heavily on natural resources extraction. And then there are some tribes that would like to have, say, improved gaming operations in a different market, maybe a more urban market. And, you know, a presidential campaign, a Senate campaign could make some promises in that regard that I think could really skew a vote in relation to a particular tribe. That last part really hasn't happened yet. But I would say that in places like, you know, Crow Country or Southern Ute Tribe in Colorado, those tribes really are dependent on natural resource extraction, and there's some of their interests align with the Republican Party at times.
There was a widely circulated chart that I think originated with CNN showing a breakdown of voter preferences. And it listed Black voters, Latinx voters, white voters, and then this whole category that the authors of the chart described as something else. And a lot of Indigenous folks around the country took issue with it, among others. How common is it for media and politicians to just not even take Native American voters into their political calculations and conversation?
Well, it's very common, not just politicians, but many organizations. Our numbers, relatively speaking, are pretty small. But if you get into a state like Arizona or New Mexico, where the Native vote is upwards of 10% of the whole population, you really do so at your own risk. And I will have to say, in relation to that CNN graphic, you know, us Native people really do think we're something else. So it's kind of funny.
You know, I do wonder a lot in a place like Michigan, where certainly there can be a count of Native voters living, you know, on tribal land. I wonder if you think a lot of people really even understand Native populations in an urban setting and the role that they might play in elections where they haven't been counted as tribal members, but that they may be making an impact on the vote.
Yeah, you know, urban Indians are often very racially mixed. And so their relatives might be a wide variety of different types of ethnicities and races. And, you know, news organizations like CNN like for people to be in a nice compartmentalized racial category. You know, us Americans love to characterize people, classify people on the basis of race and sex, that sort of thing. But, you know, Native people in urban areas are often very mixed, and they have really an outsized impact. So they're sort of swept in with other racial categories or just referred to as other, but they have very Native interests at heart that are really impactful in the way they vote. And, you know, it's hard to track that sort of thing if you're a pollster or if you're a politician thinking about trying to create some sort of political movement. They're not the easiest group to track down.
What can you tell us about the history of voter suppression in Native communities?
The history of Native voter suppression is really quite impressive. The Voting Rights Act from the 1960s established that states in the South had to go to the Attorney General whenever they wanted to change their voting laws in order to get permission effectively to do something different because of their long history of voter suppression of Black and African American folks. But included in those lists of jurisdictions that had to do what they call preclearance were dozens upon dozens of counties around the country in South Dakota, Michigan, Alaska, Arizona, New Mexico, Utah, all over the place. And those were all Native counties. You know, these counties really worked really hard to suppress the Native vote, dilute the Native vote. There were still litigation well into the 1960s and 70s in a lot of states, where states would say, well, you're not loyal to the United States because you're a member of a federally recognized tribe, therefore you can't vote in our election. Just flagrantly trying to stop Native people from voting. And this is an ongoing thing. You know, in rural counties in and around Indian country, racism is really quite endemic. Some of my students at the law school have complained that back home, you know, we're all teaching virtually and from a distance. Back home, they still struggle with the same kind of suppression. You know, you show up with your ID that says you're from a reservation, you have a P.O. box as an address, and the nice people that are there at the election booth, the poll workers are really don't know what to do with that. And so they just say, you need to leave until you come back with a real ID and that sort of thing. So these voter ID requirements are really quite discriminatory toward Native people. And that's really quite intentional in a lot of jurisdictions.
Michigan is the state with the largest Native population east of the Mississippi. How much influence would you say Native folks in Michigan have had on elections here?
You know, that's a really good question. I hear tell that there's upwards of 100,000 Native people in the state that could vote. And I think that our vote is sort of a sleeping giant. And I just don't see that the impact has been there quite yet. You know, the Upper Peninsula in northern Michigan is really quite strongly Republican, but Native people in those jurisdictions tend to vote Democrat. And, you know, it's not even really close yet. And I had a sense that many Native people who live in Indian Country in Michigan still are not quite convinced that the state and federal government really matters to them that much. And I think that's going to change. My children's generation, my generation is starting to realize that our vote is really quite impactful. You know, when we look at the issues that matter to us most, things like Line 5, Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Superior, our treaty rights, so far, there's really only been one, you know, major political party that's been really receptive to our concerns about that issue. And even there, it's sort of a mixed message a lot of the time. So I think that the Michigan Native vote hasn't been as impactful as it could be, but it, like I say, I think it is a sleeping giant and could be in future generations, maybe as soon as the next election, could be really impactful.
Do you think the 2020 elections may have gotten some more people's attention about what is possible if campaigners are speaking overtly to Native people? Or, I mean, I almost wonder if Native intervention in some, you know, some of the pipeline disputes that we've been talking about lately might also be something that would make people stand up and take notice.
I think so. You know, without getting into it too much, I don't want to pick on the Democrat Party, both federal and state, but I don't think they've done what they could do to court the Native vote in Michigan. I think what's going to happen is that you're going to see some more Native people, some of them who are alums of the law school where I teach, are going to run for office and they're going to start to win. When you have a strong Native vote in places out west, Montana, New Mexico, Arizona, you have Native people in office in state government, and have more people thinking about being in office in federal government. So you have a member of Congress, well, actually two Native members of Congress now in New Mexico.
Cherise Davids and Deb Haaland, yeah.
Yeah, Cherise Davids in Kansas. And
oh, I'm sorry,
well.
Yes.
So no problem. You know, I think that helps to get Native people, you know, sort of in the door. And then they start thinking about courting the Native vote because then it starts to matter to the greater party, which, you know, it shouldn't be that way. It should be the other way around, where the party reaches out to the community first, you know, but I don't know that that's really happening as much as it could be in Michigan.
Do you think there's room for Native candidates on other places down the ballot? I mean, you mentioned some of the state representative races, but what about involvement in, say, county governments?
Absolutely. And you know, part of the problem is the, you know, the ongoing misunderstanding, I think, of many Native people that local government doesn't matter to them so much. I mean, I've worked many years for tribes here in Michigan. And, you know, our sort of basic stand is basically we're an antithetical to the county government. We don't need them. They should stay out of our business. And that creates this sort of pressure to not run for local government. And there have been some openings, you know, people have run for school board. You know, one of our friends and colleagues here in East Lansing, Michigan, just won a spot on the school board. So we're talking about an urban Native person who is now on the suburban, so to speak, school board. So there are places for that, but it really just hasn't caught on, especially in sort of the northern lower Michigan and upper peninsula area. I would like to see more of that as well. But the pressure, sort of the passivity, I think, of, you know, Native people towards local government, you know, is something that is hard to overcome.
You know, I was thinking about something you said about how a lot of Indian land tends to be located in more rural areas that we think of as going overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, albeit maybe to a lesser degree in this election than in 2016. And yet, when we think about the consequence of national elections, what does that positioning in the middle of historically Republican areas mean for Native voters in those same communities?
like I say, in Michigan, we have some counties that are very rural that are close to turning blue or did turn blue, like Marquette County and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. That's where the Keweenaw Indian community is. Or Grand Traverse and Leelanau counties, where Grand Traverse Band is. They are on the cusp of being blue counties. I really do think that if the tribal vote got out, you would have a switch. There really is a great, an opportunity for a party to push back on sort of the rural domination of the Republican Party. But maybe it's hit and miss based on where the reservations are. But I really do think that it would be worth it to expend some resources in getting the vote out in those counties with Indian tribes.
Matthew Fletcher is a professor of law at MSU's College of Law, and he also directs the Indigenous Law and Policy Center. Matthew, thanks for talking to us.
Absolutely. Have a good day.
4 years ago, President Donald Trump won Michigan with fewer than 11,000 votes. That was the first time since George H.W. Bush's victory in 1988 that a Republican presidential candidate won the state. Now, former Vice President Joe Biden has won Michigan, swinging state support back into the blue column. The Republican ticket this year did turn out more voters than in 2016. It was not quite enough to overtake the additional voters that showed up to vote Democratic. We've been very curious about how the state Republican Party has shifted these past few years and what issues and policies GOP folks might have on their minds going forward. Today, we're checking in with two political veterans and former state party chairs, Susie Avery and Bobby Shostak, to hear what's on their minds right now. Susie, Bobby, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Susie, you were chair of the state party from 1995 to 1996, and Bobby, you led the party in Michigan from 2011 to 2015. Could we just have both of you talk a little bit about some of the differences between the Republican Party in Michigan then and now?
So I was finance chair for 2 years under previous chair Ron Weiser, and then I followed him for 4 years. And so I came in pre-Snyder, then we got Snyder elected, and then I served 2 years following that and got him reelected. And what we were able to accomplish then was a significant increase in fundraising. When I say significant, probably double the high point of any previous administration at the party. And as a result, we had capabilities to do things that are very rare for a state party. We were the envy, frankly, of the nation, of the other chairs, because we had capital to invest in technology, to invest in voter turnout, to invest in absentee ballot chase, election day operations, and so forth. And it was, frankly, a lot of it what made the difference in Governor Snyder's reelect. Because if you recall, it got very narrow at the end.
What makes the difference in terms of money is motivating people with issues that they want to see action on. What were the issues that you feel like really were able to get the party in a position to compete?
I mean, the issues changed so much. I mean, when I was there, it was right to life, abortion, schools, private versus charters, and all this kind of stuff. The issues have changed significantly, but I have to just take off my hat to Bobby and to Ron, because Ron Weiser, because as chairman, they did what no other chairman in the United States, they did stuff that nobody really understood why they were doing it at the time. And it turned out that they were doing it to get a winning ticket.
So fast forward to 2016, and Donald Trump comes onto the scene and wins using a strategy that many traditional Republicans said wouldn't work. He did not talk about traditional Republican issues like limited government and fiscal conservatism. He had an overtly populist mission about pride in America and American jobs, and sometimes said overtly nationalist and racist things. What did you make of him at the time?
Well, one thing he did was he energized the party. I mean, there's a lot of energy still around him in Michigan. So he brought people in who had not voted before, to be blunt about it. He raised the level of African-Americans who voted for him in Michigan. He raised the level of Hispanics and Latinos in Michigan who voted for him. My husband and I own a golf course, and it's a very low end golf course. It's a dollar a hole. I mean, it's in Jackson, Michigan, if you ever want to play it. But anyway, he talked the way the people we meet talk. I mean, they didn't like the fact that in DC, they didn't feel that anybody was listening to the common guy, you know, the guy who's living paycheck to paycheck and who drinks Bud Light and just likes to go out and bowl and golf and hunt. So I think that put something back into the Republican Party, that we weren't always on this real high plane of rich white people talking about stuff.
I also think that he was the outsider. And he was able to connect with people because of that. I think the American public, the voting public, has had it, and at that time had it, with the traditional, you know, politician operating the same way, being in the swamp, as he referred to it, too long, and being influenced by the swamp. And he came in, he was the disruptor. You know, it's unfortunate from my perspective that he didn't clearly win re-election, and we're in this mess that we're in. Hopefully we'll sort out all the voting issues around it. The results will be the results, and we'll move on from there. But I think it's completely understandable and explainable why Donald Trump won last time.
Coming up, we continue our conversation on the future of the Republican Party post-Trump.
Well, he's currently the president, and he's currently the head of the Republican Party. What that means in the future is to be determined.
That's next. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Let's get back to my conversation about the future of the state's Republican Party with two political veterans, also former state party chairs, Susie Avery and Bobby Shostak. We talked to them about the present moment and the future for the GOP. We can say now that Donald Trump's effect on the Michigan electorate this time around was a mixed bag. He unquestionably boosted Republican turnout, but also Kent County went blue. Some other traditionally Republican counties, like Leelanau County, showed higher support for Biden, or at least less support for Trump. And you've got reliably GOP suburbs like Livonia and Dexter and Chelsea going for Joe Biden.
But the Republicans held the House. And not only did they hold the House, I mean, the political wisdom has always been whoever's on the top of the ticket will win all the university board seats. That has been in place for 40 years. What we found this time is, okay, Biden might have won, but you know what? Republicans won three seats. I mean, we won one on the U of M board, one on the Michigan State board, and one on U of M, Michigan State, and Wayne State. So people are no longer voting just by straight party tickets. Like Bobby said, they're voting for the candidate. Now, okay, they came out and they voted for Biden, but you know what? They also voted a Republican person from Kent County, Pete Meyer, into the Congress. They also voted a person from a new congresswoman out of St. Clair County. So I don't think it's as easy just to say, well, Michigan's turned blue. I think it's more reasonable to say, okay, there was people that voted for Biden, but then they went over and they voted for Republicans too. A very interesting phenomenon, I think, in terms of this election.
Well, I think the question is less, is Michigan going to turn blue again, but what flavor of red might it be able to stomach? I mean, is the head of the party right now Donald Trump, or is it the party of Rick Snyder going forward? Bobby, what do you think?
I don't know what the party of Rick Snyder means. You're talking about for the state of Michigan, I guess. No, when there's a Democrat in the office, the leader of the party is the party chairman. And the party is going to reflect those values of the state committee and reflect the values of the county chairs and so forth, the district chairs. And they will huddle up in the midwinter and prepare their platform for how to take on the governor in the next election and so forth. You know, Susie mentioned, you know, the voting this year, particularly the state house. We weren't expecting to be able to keep the state house, and they worked their tails off. And we have the same margin going into next year that we have currently, which is remarkable in a year like this. So, you know, I'm pretty optimistic about what the party will be, what it will represent, and the success going forward. Again, it's important that they raise the money and they communicate the message and they have the technology And I think that they built on what was done before them and continue to make it better. They're going to do just fine.
Right now, we've got a state party chair who is echoing Donald Trump's interest in challenging the election results, repeating baseless accusations of there being widespread fraud in Wayne County, despite the fact that Joe Biden won on a margin that was not that close. I guess my question is, it seems like the party reckoning over Donald Trump and whether he continues to be the way forward is kind of being delayed by this whole election process. How long can Michigan's Republican Party continue to stick to what Donald Trump is saying when he is the guy who lost the election?
All right, let me respond. You used the word baseless accusations. Okay, there is affidavits signed by individuals who were told to backdate ballots at Cobo Hall at TCF. So that's not baseless, okay, number one. Number two is there was clearly some sort of computer glitch that was discovered at Antrim County. That same software suite, not necessarily all of it, but the same suite was used in 47 counties in the state. So whether the margin is big enough to overcome the 100 and some odd thousand votes, you know, that's problematic, but we'll find out, I guess. But I think it's fair that when roughly half the population, voting population, voted for the president, Donald Trump, that we make certain for our future that all legal ballots are counted. Now, whether it'll turn around the election is a secondary issue, change the results. And I think it's important, and Laura Cox has taken a position that's the right position, that let's explore where these deficiencies came. And it'll take some time, but not a lot of time. It won't take as long as time as it did with Bush v. Gore. That went on and on forever. So I think it's fair to make certain that we have honest, accurate, without fraud elections.
So the affidavits that you're talking about are part of a case that is not going forward in court because a judge found the accusations baseless. And Chris Thomas, longtime Michigan Secretary of State, and somebody who people of both parties express a lot of respect for, has clarified what happened, that clerk employees forgot to enter dates into the qualified vote file computer system. The absentee ballots were stamped having been received, but they weren't entered into the computer system as having been received. He characterized that as a clerical error. Also, the Antrim County situation was overseen by a Republican clerk who spent so much time answering angry phone calls from voters once the story got out in the media that she had trouble reporting results in a timely fashion. I mean, I don't see how the party can keep holding on to the narrative unless it's with an understanding that Donald Trump's future in the party is assured. It sounds like where we're going with this is that he is still the head of the party. Would you agree?
Well, he's currently the president, and he's currently the head of the Republican Party. What that means in the future is to be determined. But I don't think that all of the cases are dismissed. And I think that until that has all been litigated or dismissed, we won't know the final results. And I think it's fair. Like I said, I don't know, and I doubt whether it will change the results in Michigan, but in other states where it's, you know, 10,000 and 20,000 votes, it might. And so it's their right to make certain that the all legal votes were counted properly. And we should allow them to do that. 70 million voters voted for each side. Okay. But if the shoe was on the other foot, they'd have the same expectation.
One of the things Donald Trump was able to do was break this consensus that the Democratic Party is the party of blue-collar workers, and blue-collar white union workers in particular. This shift over the past few cycles has been really strong for the party, like you say, drawing in people who haven't been involved before. Susie, I had a question for you, though. This past round of election results shows the Democratic Party picking up more suburban voters and more women. You know, you're former chair of the Michigan Women's Commission. What do you make of the fact? I mean, does the Republican Party need to lean in to try to win some of those voters back? And if so, how to do that?
Well, I mean, The fact that there were more voters, period, for the Democrats, for the Democratic presidential in terms of suburban women, and I have to say, in some other areas, will probably be something for that Republicans will be discussed. But I do have that we'll be discussing, and we'll be talking about that as Bobby said, next year. When they start to develop all the policies and the platform. But what I find incredible in all this is that the numbers of suburban women who came out was significantly more than in 2016. So everyone is comparing this to 2016. The problem in 2016 is there was not as many voters that came out. So you're seeing more suburban women voting for Biden. But the thing is that those were Hillary Clinton voters that did not vote for Hillary. They didn't like her. I'm sorry. There was a whole big deal in Michigan. I know Hillary's people disagree with me, and we've had several arguments about it. But she was a bad candidate. And people, whether you were a suburban woman or an urban man or whatever, you didn't like her. And so the vote was not there. I just think we're comparing it to 2016 when we should just be looking at it from a 2020 perspective.
If you're just joining us, my guests today are Susie Avery and Bobby Shostak. They've both spent time as chair of Michigan's Republican Party, and we're talking about the party's future after Donald Trump. How does the Republican Party in Michigan need to address race and how Donald Trump talks about race?
Well, I think we started to do that. We've set up urban centers now. We have co-chairs that have gone out into the community, start talking. I mean, we know that you can't just go to a big event and show up and say, oh boy, here's a Republican, you know, isn't this great? I mean, we know we have to do things like go to barbershops, and we have to start meaningful dialogues that neither side is afraid to talk about. We try to do that in MPLP, actually. We have several discussions about race that are difficult, but because there's a trust there and they know each other, it's easier to do it within that particular area. And I think that can be done in the Republican Party also. And I think it is being done, to be quite blunt about it.
Yeah, I was going to say it is being done. It's been done for years. We need to be, people want to be involved with their own people in leadership positions, in elected positions, in the driver's seat for discussions is these exact topics. And I think the Republican Party for years has been very inclusive and taking on difficult discussions by doing what should be done. And that's full participation by everyone who wants to be involved. We're welcome. We're a big tent. We're available for opinions and perspectives, and we got to be good listeners. And I think we've been doing it. We got to continue to do it. Donald Trump's comments that, you know, you and others and often people find inappropriate, you know, need to be considered as well. And in the process of being inclusive and having inclusion, we got to face that and address it and make all folks comfortable to be a part of the Republican agenda, the conservative agenda, the agenda that's best for our state. And its future and everybody's children.
This is a year when the only Republican candidate who was a person of color was also a Senate candidate. And that's John James. And he lost to Gary Peters. He did not do well in Detroit or Oakland County, but perhaps better in Oakland County than some people expected. How then does that support the Republican Party moving forward with diverse candidates and diverse issues?
Well, I don't see the Democratic Party having anyone of color serving as a U.S. senator from Michigan.
Fair. I just wanted to ask what both of you want to see the party do and focus on going forward. Susie, do you want to start? And then Bobby, we'll hear from you, too.
Well, I think we proved in the House races that if you have great candidates, you will win elections. And it necessarily sometimes isn't built on name ID or who is your mother, who is your father, or anything like this. That's why America is such a good place to to be able to run for office, unlike most other countries, you can just get out there and state what you want to and see if they accept what you want to. And I always tell people who lose on both sides of the aisle, actually, that, you know, this isn't the end of it. Come in here and run again. Come back. Come to party meetings. Come to see what the Republican Party is all about. And I think the more people at the table who sit around the table and who are in the room are terrific. And I think that that's what the Republicans are doing now.
How about you, Bobby? Are these gains and then the possibility of the next couple of years, are they in spite of what just happened in this election or because of it?
Yeah, I think the gains are going to come from what Susie said, and elections are won and parties are built around ground games, around voter engagement, around volunteers doing what they need to do to connect the candidates with the agenda, with the platform, and with the voters to win. It's always hard to beat an incumbent governor in office, but we have the Senate to protect, and we just like we do with the House this year. And I'm sure we'll field a strong gubernatorial candidate, and we'll do the best we can to win that seat back. But even if we don't, keeping the Senate Republican is a top priority, and the party needs to build itself around that agenda. That's our firewall for Republicans to keep things in check.
You know, I know what you're saying is true, and I know that you believe what you're saying is true about the shoe leather and the volunteerism and the work. However, arguably, the party is still in the grip of a leader who is talking less about candidates and doing the work and connecting with voters, and more about an election that was improperly conducted and trying to talk to people about a sense of entitlement about their fellow Americans. Is that the reality of what's happening on the ground right now?
Well, I mean, you want to keep coming back to this question, this issue, you know, is this Donald Trump Republican Party, you know, going to be, you know, forever the message and the approach? And, you know, regardless, you know, of anyone's individual opinion, state parties will develop their priorities and develop their message and communicate that throughout the state to do what needs to be done, and that's to be victorious. And so I'm less concerned about, you know, I think what you're trying to get to is, you know, alienation of voters because of messaging coming out of the president. Well, I understand the concern, and I'm not saying that there isn't an impact to voters on that dialogue. But what's more important is what our candidates say who are running for office. What's more important is what our volunteers motivated and inspired to do what needs to be done to win elections. And the party chair, the county chairs, the infrastructure, state committee and all, when they come together, it's a powerful force to inspire the outcomes that we need. We've done it before, and we'll do it again. And we've got a good infrastructure in place going back now a decade and going into the future that's going to continue to make it a strong Republican Party in Michigan and a strong group of messengers to help take it out to the public.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for being here. It's obviously an extremely interesting time for the Republican Party with a lot of things still in flux. Bobby Shostak is with Mad Dog Technology and with Templar Baker Consulting, former chair of the Michigan Republican Party, and Susie Avery has been with us too, a former state party chair who's now co-chair of the Michigan Political Leadership Program at Michigan State University.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Just a quick note today before we wrap up. You might remember on Monday, we spoke with a manager from Spectrum Health about the second wave of COVID cases surging through West Michigan. We just learned today the hospital says its caseload is still building. In fact, things have reached a point where Spectrum CEO Tina Friesdecker says the hospital system has started deferring inpatient surgeries. While we heard on Monday that capacity issues can be difficult to pin down, Decker says West Michigan's hospitals will be at capacity, quoting here, within days. Kent County confirmed 851 new cases yesterday, and Michigan's statewide total set another new daily record with 6,473 active cases. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.